Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. Did the Nazis win power in 1933 because of the popular appeal of their message or through the divisions and miscalculations of their opponents? In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about how the Nazis won with only a third of the vote.
In this programme, we're going to look at the Nazi rise to power, and we're going to take forward the previous programme, which was on the Weimar Republic, and in many senses, you ought to, as it were, listen to that first. These are in a sequence. But equally, they stand on their own. In the case of the Nazi rise to power, there are, as so often in historical interpretations, different traditions, different levels of analysis, different tendencies. But if one was to try and shape those in terms of a easy to approach dichotomy, you would have, on the one hand, an account which very much focuses on the public as a whole, the electorate, the rise of political extremism at the end of the Weimar period as a result of strains caused by the Great Depression. And on the other hand, you have an emphasis on the actions and intentions, and often errors, because what happened was not what their intentions were, of a relatively small group of politicians. And this dichotomy is one that we're well used to. One can think, for example, of the work of Maurice Cowling and his argument that, you know, a relatively small number of politicians is what one needs to look at if one's looking at the impact in Britain of either the rise of Labour or the response to World War II, the response to Hitler and the going into World War II, or we can look at Sir Lewis Namier's work on the anatomization of British politics in the 1760s, both of those focused on a relatively small group of people, whilst conversely, as listeners will know, other tendencies have looked at broader inclinations, broader groups. And in the case particularly of the rise of the Nazi Party, this links in to a more general question of how far the German public had endorsed, embraced extremism, and how far this characterizes the Third Reich, the situation of the government established system established by Hitler from 1933. So bearing both of those in mind, I'm going to try and give you a brief narrative, but be aware that at any time one could, as it were, pull back and say, yes, but what about the other point of view or the other tendency? And that question would be a perfectly reasonable one. By the nature of things in history, we cannot repeat the experiment. We certainly hope not to repeat the experiment of the rise of the Third Reich, but we cannot repeat the experiment. And therefore, it is not helpful to assert definitively that it is one question rather than another. So you may recall that last time I was talking about how Heinrich Brüning of the Centre Party became Chancellor in 1930 as a result of Hindenburg putting him into power, and that Brüning used Hindenburg to issue presidential emergency decrees, creating a form of authoritarian democracy. Now, no Reichstag elections were due until 1935, but Brüning was forced to resign in May 32 by Hindenburg. And Hindenburg plays a more prominent role in the story than sometimes people are inclined to emphasize. Hindenburg replaces him by the conservative Franz von Papen, who was a protege of Hindenburg's authoritarian advisor, General Kurt von Schleicher. Now, Schleicher had intrigued against the former chancellor, and Papen again ruled by emergency decrees signed by Hindenburg. So in one respect, this is another instance of the authoritarian democracy. In another aspect, it's Hindenburg using the kind of powers that one might have seen or envisaged on, as it were, in the pre-World War I German monarchy. Papen himself was more willing to go along with some aspects of the role of the Nazis in politics than his predecessor had been. Brüning had banned the Nazi paramilitary SA, which was murderously violent, in April 1932. And Papen, in turn, lifted this ban in June. He also overthrew the leading, the largest regional government, that of Prussia, which was SPD dominated, and therefore a strong potential rival to the federal government, while wages and unemployment pay were cut in September. The Reichstag election was held on the 31st of July, 1932, and the Nazis won the largest number of seats with 37% of the vote, which contrasted to 18% in 1930 and only 2% in 1928. The SPD, in contrast, in 32 won 22%, the Communists 14%, and the Centre Party 12%. Now, as you will see from those figures, that did not produce a majority, and instead of which you have instability that leads on the 6th of November 32 to another election in which the Nazis, with 33% of the vote, lost seats. The Communists went up from 14 to 17%, the SPD down from 22 to 20%. So roughly similar, but with, you know, shifts. Papen, who still couldn't rely on sufficient Reichstag support, was forced to resign by Schleicher, who insisted that the army, which he claimed to, as it were, represent in the corridors of power, could not support the Papen government. So there was then a political reconstruction in December 32. Hindenburg replaces Papen with Schleicher, so he moves up from being Minister of Defense to being the Chancellor, and that leads Papen to plot with Hitler. In January 33, Papen persuades Hindenburg that he could keep Hitler under control if Hitler replaced Schleicher. The army had made preparations for a declaration of a state of emergency in order to combat communist disorder. But there was no such action against the Nazis, and Hindenburg refused Schleicher's request for a state of emergency, as a result of which Schleicher resigns, and a new government is formed on the 30th of January 1933 with Hitler as Chancellor, Papen as Vice-Chancellor, and his supporters in a majority in the cabinet. Although these individuals were to fail to resist what is a rapid seizure of power and authority by Hitler, and they were to be politically marginalized. Now, before we push on to look at how Hitler then used his position as Chancellor, let's just try and recap. On the one hand, we are talking about a situation of a small number of men, principally Brüning, Hindenburg, Papen, Hitler, and Schleicher, and others as well, obviously, and how they interact. On the other hand, one has got a root point that the percentage of the vote enjoyed by the Nazis has gone up to over 30%, and that in combination with the vote enjoyed by the communists, which is over 10%, leads to a real problem of governability for the political system. And you have here All the drawbacks of proportional representation, the way in which the SPD can't control the communists, the way in which the moderate right doesn't contain the far right. So instead of having, as it were, a two or three party system, you have a multi-party system, with the extremes in this context enjoying a lot of support. And if you're looking for the reason for the enjoying a lot of support, it isn't really helpful to simply refer to the actions and doings of a small group of people, because the election results were not, as it were, faked. There really was genuinely a lot of support for the Nazis, and they genuinely were the largest political party. In both of the general elections, the Reichstag general elections of 1932. And that cannot be argued away by referring to some sort of coup from the centre. Equally, the process by which Hitler becomes Chancellor was not an automatic one that follows from the electoral support. So before looking further, I wonder if we can pause and possibly, Graham, if you've got any points you'd like to make on the particular matters we've just discussed.
Well, thank you, Professor Black. There's a large number of questions which I think you've stimulated in what you said in your introductory remarks. I'd like to begin, if I may, by asking about the nature of, as it were, Weimar's authoritarian democracy just in the period before those two general elections give the Nazis such an electoral boost in the Reichstag. Why was it necessary for von Papen to be using decree powers, or Hindenburg facilitating the use of decree powers? Why couldn't the Reichstag have functioned properly?
Well, I suppose you've got the problem that you haven't got a majority to support the policies of the government. And in that situation, you turn to the presidency to help deal with the political issue. I mean, in a way, you could say, I'm not saying there's any equivalence, but, you know, you could look at the crisis in Britain in 1931, where there is grave difficulties for the Labour government, a minority Labour government. And in the end, George V, as it were, acts to try and get some sort of political cohesion, a kind of national government, as had happened in World War I, wherein, again, he'd played a role there. But clearly the context and the traditions and the situation and the course of events is very different in Germany in 30, 31, 32, 33.
There's an interesting counterfactual, isn't there, on what would have happened if Weimar Germany had had a first-past-the-post system, electoral system, rather than a form of proportional representation. I mean, I'm very struck by the fact that we talk about the Nazis from 33 being the largest party on getting just under a third of the vote, third of the popular vote, which is roughly what John Major got in the 1997 general election, where he was defeated in a landslide. But of course, in that system, the opposition manifested itself to him in a Labour Party, which therefore dominated the result in Britain. In Germany in 1932 and 1933, we don't have that system. It's very fractured amongst the other parties. Why was it that there was no proper unity between the Catholic Centre Party and a more cohesive, as it were, Liberal Conservative Party, which could have represented the middle class and the non-socialist vote?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. I think you could rephrase that slightly. There was a moderate Conservative Party in the Centre Party. It just didn't have the votes. And there are different ways of looking at it. You could contrast the situation on the left. On the left, the SPD is larger than the communists in both the 32 elections. On the right, the Nazis are larger than the Centre Party. So, I mean, a lot of this has got to do with the electoral support. The Nazi popularity rests on far more than just a rejection of Weimar and its real and alleged failures. Nazism, unfortunately, had electoral support spanning all social groups, regional perspectives, ages and genders. Their particular areas of strength, notably small town and Protestant Germany — Germany is preponderantly Protestant, as in Holstein and Thuringia — but the Nazis could also draw on the strength of pre-First World War right-wing stringent German nationalism, on racism, on bitter anti-Semitism. Nazism is Volkisch with its focus on a general nationalism that was very popular with a lot of people. And I think, you know, the argument that, as it were, this is a failure of the moderate right, I mean, you could reconceptualize that and say, well, actually, unfortunately, and everyone gives me no pleasure to say this, it was the appeal of the extreme right that was the key element here, and the willingness of so many Germans to vote for it. If you want to use counterfactualism, you can, and, you know, I think, if you, you know, let's play with British politics in the 20-teens. You had all the Liberal Democrats urging proportional representation in the referendum in the early days of the Cameron government. That was defeated. It would certainly have helped the Liberal Democrats, but in 2015, it would have led to even more MPs for what, Graham?
For UKIP.
Yes, indeed. Or if you look at the French system, Mitterrand deliberately, you know, bolstered, built up the extreme right, the Le Pen movement, in order to weaken the moderate right. And you could argue that Macron is the heir to that, that, you know, Macron being able to say it's either me or Marine Le Pen was able to actually win it for Macron because the moderate right was less popular than the far right. But there is absolutely no doubt about it that proportional representation systems, which are beloved by a certain, shall we say, tendency of commentator in Britain, are in practice actually going to deliver to you fragmentation and extremism. And Germany was an instance of that.
You mentioned that the Nazis drew appeal across regions, across classes, and across gender. Given that it's a secret ballot and that opinion polling is in its infancy at this time, is it possible to do the research? Has the research been done as to, for example, whether men were more likely than women to vote for the Nazis, or you know, exactly drilling down into the sophology of who voted how?
Yes, the sophological work's pretty good, actually, and there's also some rather good mapping of it as well. I mean, there are areas where the Nazis pro rata were less popular than their average vote. Berlin was a good example of that. The big industrial cities were good examples of that. In all of these areas, there were more, you know, there was a pro rata more for the left than there were for the Nazis. The Nazis, you know, were, and also for that matter, the more, as it were, conservative parties of the right, traditional conservative parties of the right, enjoyed strength in significant parts, in particular of southern Germany. Interestingly enough, and there is work on this, interestingly enough, there was some continuities. If you then look at voting maps In West Germany in the post-1945 fashion, and there are even some continuities into the post-unification or reunification, depending upon your point of view and idiom. But there is specialist work on this, and it's interesting. There are, you know, there were quite, Nazism was both a national political movement and one that was more strongly observed and followed in some areas than others, but not to the extent of, for example, 1930s United States, where you would have found extraordinarily few Republicans in the South, for example.
Mm-hmm. To what extent was the Nazi appeal directed against the they saw as the corruption and uselessness of the Weimar Republic? And to what extent would you say it was a anti-left movement dedicated to making out the SPD to be very radical? Indeed, I'd be interested to know how radical you think the SPD was in this period, and also obviously the KPD, the power of the communists.
Well, again, that's a fascinating question. I think there are a number of ways you can look at this. First of all, Nazism itself was an incoherent movement. And by that, I mean, it was, in practical terms, a coalition, not a coalition in the sense of a willing, let's all have a chat. I mean, but in the sense that Hitler drew together on different tendencies, which often were have incompatibilities. The same, incidentally, if you look at my history of Italy, I make the same point about Benito Mussolini's fascism. So this incoherent nature of Nazism was an aspect of its strength. It meant the movement could reach out to a large number of electoral constituencies or popular constituencies. And partly it did that through responding to what it saw, and indeed what were, popular drives and discontents. So there were core groups and regions. For example, young men tended to very much be a group where overrepresented among Nazism, but backing was also a wide-ranging. There was consent as well as coercion, collusion as well as coping. And what you've got is there was more regional and local research into Nazism from the 1980s, and that managed to show that the impact of specific political, social, and ideological milieu helped the Nazis, although also acting as limitations of them. Now, I mean, what I would say apropos your specific point is, yes, there was obviously criticism of Weimar. It's always easy to criticize. And yes, there was a calling on the vicarious hatreds, the atavistic loathings of, you know, unpleasant sectors of German society. But there was also a kind of, both in international relations and in domestic policy, a sort of broad brush delusional set of promises that Nazism offered. It sort of promised people a role. It promised those who were, shall we say, from the middling orders, if you wish to use the term middle class, a sense of their importance, self-importance. It promised members of the elite side of kind of anti-communist protection, as well as a sense of German greatness. And, it was a socialist movement. It promised to seek full employment. It promised to look after the ordinary German. So Nazism, rather like Mussolini's fascism, offered different messages. I mean, you know, there was masses of hatred, loathing, viciousness in there, but it actually offered messages of hope for a lot of Germans and messages of identity. I mean, the reality of them, of course, proved very different, although a lot of Germans profited under peacetime Nazism and some profited under wartime Nazism. But I think it's worth saying that it's more than just an anti-Weimar party.
Right. I want to a look at the non-Nazi right a little bit more, if I may, and just tease out a bit more on your thinking on von Papen and Schleicher as well. How right-wing were they? I mean, they obviously didn't share the methods of the Nazis, but did they have common views in terms of foreign policy? Did they have some of the interventionist economic ideas that the Nazis proposed? Or were they more an old-style conservative party, which allowed themselves to be outmaneuvered by the wilier Nazis?
Well, they were certainly more of an old-style conservative party. I mean, as far as outmaneuvered by the Nazis, I mean, there was a hell of a lot of contingency there that ended up with the situation we were in. Von Papen and Schleicher both look back to pre-1914 elites. These elites had continued after World War I. In the case of both men, they represent the anti-communist, anti-socialist tendencies of the Weimar Right, which had been dominant in the right until the very rapid rise of Nazism. And I think one ought to look at that. And one ought to also bear in mind that the direction that things were going into was very unpredictable. I mean, you know, you get some people thinking there's going to be a monarchist revanche, including the Kaiser. So there are different rights on offer, and which one is to emerge is not immediately clear. The same thing, incidentally, one could say on the left. And also bear in mind, we refer to the communists. The communists, of course, had, as it were, the schism between the Stalinists and the Trotskyites. There are different tendencies within the socialists. The idea that these are clear-cut, coherent political groupings and is, I think, questionable. Incidentally, I have to say, I think the same thing is true. We'll move completely aside from Germany in the early 30s. I think the same thing is true of Germany or Britain or America today. In a democratic system, there is a terrible tendency to assume that major political parties ought to be coherent. Well, why? I mean, they obviously draw on, different identities, different aspirations, different tactics, and they don't operate by the purge method of a Stalin, so, or for that matter, a Hitler. I think one ought to not be surprised that there are a series of political groupings, some of which find it harder to provide a coherent account of themselves in a very difficult set of circumstances as Germany is adjusting both to the strength of extremist political movements and to very difficult economic circumstances. In the case of Britain, the contrast is that there are very difficult economic circumstances. There were extremist political movements. Oswald Mosley's fascists and the communists are both extreme political movements. I think the ILP, the Independent Labour Party, is pretty extreme. But the point is, they were actually, because of the nature of the British political system and the nature of British political culture, minor in the crisis of the early 30s. In Germany, the situation plays out very differently.
Well, I think it's an important point you make about the nature of contingencies and different individuals not necessarily having a coherent strategy to work themselves through. How much do we know, though, about Papen and Schleicher and indeed Hindenburg's attitude to Hitler generally? Did they think he was a useful idiot, or did they think he was someone who was like-minded in some respects and could be controlled by his social betters in other respects? What do we actually know about what they genuinely thought about him and the Nazi Party?
Well, Schleicher was suspicious. There's no two ways about it. And of course, he, as it were, is pushed out in January 33. And of course, as you know, he is actually the most important victim in many respects, not Ernst Röhm and the SA leadership, but Schleicher, and also incidentally Schleicher's wife, are killed in the, you know, the Night of the Long Knives. Schleicher was then involved in a conservative conspiracy against the Nazis, and he was manoeuvring for position. And I think you can fairly say Schleicher was always manoeuvring for position. And I think you can fairly say that he is probably the most significant threat to the Nazi Party, former Minister of Defense, general, you know, a serious figure. Papen, well, I mean, I think it's too easy to say that Papen was tricked himself. I think that element is there, and I think that one needs to be aware of it. But I think what I would say is that Papen assumed that what was being created was another short-term ministry, and that the key political power would go on being held by Hindenburg and whoever Hindenburg turned to, and that there was no reason to believe that Hindenburg would go on entrusting the position of Chancellor to Hitler. So that, as it were, I think provides one way of looking at Papen. There are other ways of looking at Papen. In the case of Hindenburg, who in my mind was not operating on all cylinders, Hindenburg was, by this stage, he was an old man, was, I think it's fair to say, socially and politically regressive. And I think Hitler's willingness to talk the talk about a stronger Germany, I think, actually appealed to Hindenburg. But again, you know, there is a literature on Hindenburg. I wouldn't want to suggest that it is easy for me to tell you in any definitive fashion. It's just my reading of the situation is partly, if you like, that Hindenburg was didn't appreciate what might happen. But on the other hand, whilst he was in the constitutional position he was and head of the armed forces, he was in a situation that, had he wished to, he would have been able to get rid of Hitler. So it's a little difficult to say that Hindenburg, as it were, had failed to understand the potential, because until, you know, he dies, which he does on the 2nd of August 34, as president, he's really, you know, head of state, he's supreme commander of the armed forces. And that ultimately is the key thing.
So just to clarify, it wouldn't be right to describe Hindenburg as a constitutional monarch in quite in the same sense as, let us say, the king or queen in Britain, who's who's in theory head of the army. Hindenburg had obviously been, you know, one of the great generals of the First World War, so he was an active command of the army.
Well, yeah, I mean, active command is a little, you know, I mean, he's commander in chief. I mean, the army is not fighting anywhere. So active command, I'm not sure I would say that's the way to look at it. The Minister of Defense is the active commander in the sense of running military administration. But yes, Hindenburg is the figure to whom the army owes its loyalty. And incidentally, as I make clear in my history of Italy, this is a key element in Mussolini's coup. There were elements of the army that were interested in trying to stop the march on Rome. And the key position was that of the monarch, who chose not to use the army in that way. But the monarch remained the commander-in-chief, and that actually is a weakness of Mussolini's position.
We're drawing to a close, but I'd like to get your sense of whether all these missteps that have been taken leading up to Hitler assuming power, are these missteps the missteps of individual politicians who were either old and firm or didn't understand what they were doing or miscalculated what they were doing? Or were these missteps almost inevitably part of the structure of a young republic which is under huge economic and political strain?
I think both, actually. I think both. I think you're absolutely right that it is very difficult for any political system to work its way through. I mean, people tend to, I'm not in any way implying that anybody was equal in their vileness to Adolf Hitler, but people tend to forget that, you know, the world's largest democracy in the late 20th century, India, turned to, you know, dictatorship in under Mrs. Gandhi, that the new Republic of the United States in 1800, the contested election led to talk of the use of force. And by, you know, 1815, you've got the Hartford Convention and people thinking about possible secession. So all states, you know, can be seen as in difficulties of the new democracies or potential democracies after World War One. There were very few still operating as democracies by the mid-1930s. Ireland was, Czechoslovakia was, but I don't think you would describe most of these new states as democracies. So you're absolutely right. It is very hard to establish a new system. And, you know, the fundamental of democracy, I've argued this in a number of podcasts, I'm not sure whether for you, but hopefully you and I could have a talk about modern British politics. The fundamental of democracy is not one person, one vote. The fundamental of democracy is believing that if the other side wins a majority, that it has the legitimacy to govern, not you yourself. In other words, that you should not try and thwart a democratic mandate, however much you might believe the other side is wrong. Now, that is a very, that's what I call a political culture as well as a political practice. And it's not easy to ground. And it wasn't easy to ground in Germany in the late 20s, early 30s, not least because there were many anti-democratic elements operating within the democracy, principally the Nazis and the communists. And, you know, that actually means that it's very hard to think. I mean, it's all very well for people, you know, to say, well, they should have put together a popular front to thwart the Nazis. I mean, only an idiot would assume that a communist party with links to Stalin is going to be a benign element in the political system. So, you know, there are practical problems that one has to consider.
Well, in the next episode, we will see what Hitler does with the power that is given to him. But for taking us through how the Nazis came to power, Professor Jeremy Black, author of A Brief History of Germany, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.